la experiencia que tenemos en el instituto, en qué grupo nos encontramos, y realizamos la pregunta.
Buenos días, mi nombre es Esperanza Jiménez, yo soy bacterióloga, estoy en la coordinación del grupo de genética de la Dirección Regional Bogotá
y
trabajo en el instituto desde hace 21 años y vinculada al laboratorio desde hace 6 años. Tengo maestría en biología.
She has a master's degree
con énfasis en biología
y genetics.
Bueno, la pregunta es la siguiente, o sea, me llama la atención cómo, si él había, pues se había negado a tomar la muestra de sangre, cómo se hizo para obtener la autorización y cómo se hizo para hacer la toma de la muestra. Okay. Esa es una.
Well, the first question is that the guy with the first persistence refuses to give his sample, DNA sample, right? You said that. So how the police convinced to give the sample and have a batch?
The answer to that question is there was a screening exercise which was voluntary. This was after the Cardiff Five had given their DNA and been eliminated. The police essentially asked people to come forward and give samples for DNA testing. It wasn't compulsory. The real killer, Jeffrey Gabor, at that time, which is, you're now talking about 2002, and towards the end of, the beginning of 2003, Jeffrey Gafford chose not to come forward and give his DNA. It wasn't compulsory. It also wasn't compulsory when he did give his DNA. But at that time, he then knew that he was actually a full suspect. And it would have been, if he had refused to give his DNA at that particular time, they would have put him under surveillance and they would have kept him under surveillance. He became a bit fatalistic about it. He thought, and he actually sort of said, I've been waiting 15 years for this, i.e. the police coming and catching him for this crime. So he actually gave his DNA voluntarily only when he was viewed as a suspect. And he had essentially realised that the game was up. They actually had a good idea that he was the real killer. And he wasn't going to get away with this any longer. So that's essentially why that happened. Does that answer your question?
Okay. I hope it does. Okay. Como expliqué antes, las muestras era algo voluntario, sí, se le pidió a las personas. Y por lo tanto, pues en esa, cuando se pidió a la comunidad, pues él no iba hacer eso voluntariamente, ¿sí? Sin embargo, a la medida que la investigación fue cerrándose en torno a él, ¿sí? Y cuando ya pues prácticamente él se dio cuenta que ya no había nada que hacer, él prácticamente le dijo a la policía que había estado esperando 15 años por ese momento de la policía llegar por él a llevárselo. Entonces, en ese momento, de forma voluntaria, dio su muestra. Okay. ¿Sí, esa es la?
Sí. ¿Y qué hacen si no es voluntario?
Más preguntas.
¿Qué hacen si no es voluntario?
Where is he now? He's in jail. Whereabouts?
I'm sorry, I should have made that clear. Jeffrey Gafford pleaded guilty in July 2003 and was sentenced to life imprisonment, as is entirely correct. Eventually, he received a tariff which was equivalent to 13 years. This means 12 years and 8 months after his conviction, he can apply for parole. He is currently in jail, and that will happen, I believe, somewhere around 2015, that he would be eligible to apply for parole. It's not certain that he will get it, but there is a real possibility, because, and that's something I will come back to when I deal with the issue of just tariffs. But yes, Jeffrey Gafford, the real murderer, is in jail.
Let me explain what is a parole, because we don't have that figure here.
Right.
People are condemned.
You want me to explain what parole is?
I know what it is.
Oh, okay.
Él está en la cárcel, está pagando una condena a cadena perpetua. Sin embargo, en los sistemas anglosajones existe la figura de perdón anticipado, donde la persona, cuando cumple ciertos requisitos, se para ante un jurado de perdón, explica las razones del por qué debe ser perdonado y se le puede conceder el perdón, es decir, que no cumpla todo el tiempo de la sentencia. A pesar de que él está condenado a cadena perpetua, se le dio el beneficio del perdón, de aplicar el perdón a los 15 años, que se van a cumplir en el 2015. Que es muy probable que no se lo conceda, pero es una posibilidad que existe. Entonces,
¿en qué hacen cuando no es voluntario?
Sí. Bueno, la otra inquietud es, entiendo que a partir de ese caso pudo haberse generado alguna legislación sobre la regulación del uso de las bases de datos, o a partir de qué momento hubo como la generación, y si hay, qué tipo de legislación hay.
Okay. She's asking about if there, because of this case, the UK judicial system did a special legislation about the use of DNA bases, or what is the current uses of the DNA bases, if they are under a legislation, special legislation, because of that case, or some special measures were taken because of all the things that happened with the Fight Cardiff.
Right, well, there are, the DNA database has always been independent of the police. Originally, it was run by the Forensic Science Service. At some point, it was actually realized that this was not the best way to go about it, because the Forensic Science Service also conducted DNA testing and gave evidence in court about various DNA tests that they had conducted. And it was seen that unless you had a DNA database that was independent of the forensic scientists who were likely to give evidence, there was going to be accusations of bias, and there was going to be challenges on the basis of DNA links from the National DNA Database. What happened as a result of this case is, unfortunately, not many people realised the importance of it. It actually said that there were methods that you can use, investigative methods, which, to the credit of the police, they will always share information with other forces. So the methods that were used to solve this case, which were remarkable and very, very important, are shared among the police. The strange thing about this is that it's the other side, the people you think would have the most interest in this, people who were protesting their innocence for many, many years. You would think they would be taking notice of this and saying, I want this in my case. No, if you don't get a match between the... I should actually explain. The way the National DNA Database works is it will have crime scene samples stored on a part of it, and it will also have the DNA profiles of convicted criminals, and among them who are not actually convicted are people who have been arrested on any particular offence, even if the offence is not proceeded with or the person is acquitted. They were allowed to store the sample even afterwards, and I will come to this later, because there are other vindication cases which are very, very, very important. And they could not have been solved if you weren't allowed to keep the DNA of people who had not been convicted. This eventually is the thing that solved it. But getting back to the point of the actual changes of this, I've been arguing for a very, very long time that what you really need here is a national DNA database that contains as many people as you can get. But to do that, you need the consent of the public. There will be some civil rights issues, but I would argue there's an even bigger civil rights issue, which is the right not to be victim of a violent crime, the right not to be murdered, and equally importantly, the right to prove yourself innocent very, very quickly. There is nothing that is capable of doing this quicker, better, and more efficiently than a national DNA database. Because what is not realised is people measure the success of a national DNA database by the number of convictions. This is the wrong way to look at it. What you should be saying is, in every single one of these cases, it has eliminated everyone bar one person. It actually is the best means of proving innocence that you can get. It actually helps the very people you would think have most to oppose this, the people who the police think are likely to be the real perpetrator of these offences. They will go and arrest them, they will go and question them, but with a national DNA database, the person who is suspected would then be able to say to the police, have you got a match between my DNA and the crime scene samples? And if the answer to that is no, then go away. You've got no reason to question me. So it actually is the best thing you can get in terms of proving innocence and supporting innocence. So the answer to your question is, there is still a debate going on about how important this is. It is known in investigative circles and policing circles how to use the DNA database. The sad part of it, and it's very effective, there have been other cases that have been solved by familial DNA through the DNA database. That's one of the things that came out of this case, at least partly. But it actually is very, very important on the other side of it, because you will have some cases which are miscarriages of justice, and you might be able to prove it by using the same methods. So that, again, have I answered your question?
I think he does. Bueno, la respuesta la extendió maestro que usted le había preguntado. Cuando esto sucedió, los servicios de DNA, o de análisis de DNA, estaba a cargo del servicio de servicios forenses. Pero ellos también hacían, o sea, eran jugaban como juez y parte. Entonces, esto a partir de ahí se independizó del Servicio Nacional de Servicios Forenses, y para evitar que hubiese el sesgo, que los sistemas judiciales empezaran a pegarse porque esto pudieran ser pruebas sesgadas, o sea, ser la misma persona que administra la base de datos, la misma que haga los análisis. Entonces, a partir de eso sí se independizó. Sin embargo, todavía hay debate sobre el uso adecuado de las bases de datos, porque muchos ven las bases de datos como una herramienta para encontrar culpables, pero nadie le da la importancia de que también sirve para encontrar inocentes, personas que han sido acusadas de forma errónea y que, pues, si no encuentran algo que los ligue a la escena del crimen con sus bases de datos, pues no tendrían por qué estarlos indiciando de crímenes que no cometieron. También explica que las bases de datos se alimentan básicamente de tres fuentes: de personas que han sido condenadas, de personas que han sido arrestadas por algún tipo criminal y no necesariamente condenadas, que la ley les permite conservar esos datos, y de escenas de crimen. That's another question.
Mi nombre es Rosely Sarazo. Yo no quería hacer una pregunta, sino básicamente algunos comentarios. Bueno, pues quería comentar con respecto a la gran utilidad que ha mostrado en todo el mundo el uso de las bases de datos. Y para todos es muy conocido que una de las bases de datos, sino la base de datos más importante o más grande en el mundo, es la del Reino Unido.
and she's awarded the UK is the biggest database in the world, the most complete.
She's awarded the UK database is the biggest in the world. Están investigando un delito que se cometió en su pueblo allá en España y cómo los medios de comunicación hacían una gran publicidad y invitaban a todas las personas de ese pueblo que tenían que donar su sangre. Y había muchos comentarios que salían incluso en el periódico, en donde en los bares y en todas partes se comentaba los hombres sobre todo tenían como el temor de donar su sangre, pero al mismo tiempo la misma sociedad como que los estaba presionando mucho, que si no daba voluntariamente la muestra, entonces quería decir que era sospechosa porque
por la muestra. Incluso the coin can flap to the other side because some people were pressured by the police telling them that if they don't give that sample voluntarily, they might be considered as a suspect. So that there should be mechanisms but that the people don't feel pressed to give the samples, you know.
Entonces había conmovido mucho a la población y todo el mundo estaba presionando para que se donaran las muestras. Aquí en Colombia el uso de las bases de datos también ha sido bastante positivo, pero nosotros lo hemos transmitido solamente para la investigación de delitos, especialmente los de mayor residencia, los casos de delitos sexuales y homicidios. Hemos tenido varias coincidencias en varios kits que han apoyado mucho las investigaciones. Que no fue en la base de datos, pero que sí apoyó muchísimo la investigación con el ADN, fue el caso que ocurrió en la estación tercera de policía. Ustedes recordarán que todo el mundo y todos los medios de comunicación estaban preocupados al padre de la menor. Y así eso se da. Esa muestra no fue realizada acá en Colombia porque hasta ahora se estaba trabajando los laboratorios de genética. Esa muestra sí fue enviada al FBI y después, como de más de 3 meses de espera de los resultados, cuando llegó la muestra, entonces resultado salió negativo, no había match entre las muestras recuperadas y fue con la misma, con la del padre, y en ese momento se cayó la investigación, porque él era, para todo el mundo, él era culpable. Entonces, para ese entonces, el fiscal de él que dirigía la investigación decidió llamar a todos los policías que estaban de turno ese día, que afortunadamente eran solamente 60, no era en un estadio de fútbol, ni mucho menos, porque si no, a todos los días y solicitaron analizar todas las 60 muestras. Cuando nosotros nos comunicamos con el FBI para procesar las 60 muestras, nos dicen que están locos. O sea, ustedes tienen que hacer primero una investigación clara, que las personas como más como que se pueda orientar la investigación, porque ¿cómo vamos a resolver otros casos? Si fuera en otra situación, también tomarían una muestra de toda la población. Entonces, es más un llamado a que, si bien las pruebas de médico son bastante útiles, también es importante tener en cuenta que son muchos los casos que tenemos que resolver, no los podemos resolver haciéndole a todas las
personas,
porque si no, todos los laboratorios comenzarían. En ese caso, se resistió las muestras, el análisis de las muestras a unas cuantas personas, y aquí efectivamente salió una que coincidió, que tuvo la coincidencia y se pudo condenar. También recuerdo mucho otro caso de un violador en serie en Medellín, que ya todas las evidencias, los testimonios y todo lo daban por culpable, y la juez estaba pendiente, perdón, la fiscal estaba pendiente ya de nuestros resultados, decidió mandarlo para que lo analizaran, lo hicieran una prueba genética, pero como por complementar algo, pero ya tenían prácticamente la condena para el señor. Y cuando llegó el resultado, se cayó totalmente la investigación, porque no coincidía con las víctimas. En ese instante, parte sirvió para que las autoridades investigadoras empezaran a mirar con mayor detalle todos los datos y todo lo que ellos habían analizado y empezaron a ver que había muchas versiones, muchos testimonios que realmente no eran completamente
You've actually predicted one of the things I was going to be talking about later, which is why you do need a full national DNA database. In response to the point you made about the Spanish case, that does happen. But part of the reason it happens is you don't have a complete DNA database. And the problem is, it is actually the most cost ineffective and, in other ways, inefficient system to not have a complete DNA database. And the reason I say this is that Spanish case, that's one case. What happens if a year down the line there's another murder, and then they want to, or another offence of the same type, and then they say, I want your DNA a second time? How many times do you have to keep going back and asking people, we want your DNA? Each time you do this, you pay for the test. It's ridiculous. If you have you take the test once, you take the test and you put their DNA profile on a national DNA database, you don't have to go to them and keep asking them for DNA profile, DNA samples for DNA testing and DNA profiling. All you have to do is check the DNA database. Consequently, the very people that are saying we are being put under pressure, if they would agree once to be DNA tested on an independent database, that's why it has to be independent. It's why the police cannot have anything to do with it apart from being clients of it. And in the same way, the defence must also be allowed to interrogate the DNA database custodian and say that, no, we want you to check the whole of the DNA database. We want you to tell us, are there any people whose familial DNA is similar enough to suggest that a member of that person's family, i.e. someone different from the suspect, could be responsible for the crime? If you do it in this manner and you ensure that there are sufficient safeguards, and there has to be, the biggest and most important of them is the independence, which has to be jealously guarded and safeguards put in place. For example, in the Spanish case that you mentioned, I expect, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the police who have gone to these people and said, give us your DNA or we will treat you as a suspect. A national DNA database can go and take that sample through one of their accredited scientists, or it can be done through the person's doctor, And then you can take them and get the, you put the sample on the DNA database. You don't have to bother them. You don't have to go to them and say, give me your DNA or I'm going to treat you as a suspect, because the DNA database is saying either, yes, this person should be treated as a suspect, and then you go and investigate them properly, or no, this person is innocent. So this is actually the way forward with this. In answer to the question about how expensive this is going to be and you can't afford it, I would say that's the wrong question. It isn't can you afford it, it's can you afford not to have it. Because in terms of cost, every single inquiry that you have to do the same thing. You need perhaps a screening exercise. That's say that, to take the Cardiff case for example, 5,000 people were gave their samples for DNA testing. What happens with the next case? Does the same 5,000 have to give their DNA again if they don't give their consent to a DNA database? That means you multiply up the cost by not having a DNA database. Add this up. Take each and every case. Have a look at how many times, how many DNA samples have been taken, how many DNA tests are required, and multiply that up by the number of cases per year. Add it up over the next 10 years and then tell me that it's more efficient not to have a national DNA database that does this once, and that it isn't actually far cheaper to have it.
Okay. Él dice que usted se le adelantó algo que él iba a tratar más adelante sobre el uso de la base de datos y la independencia que las bases de datos deben tener de DNA, que son que pues realmente hay que mirar el costo y beneficio que esto representa entre tener y no tenerla, ¿cierto? Entre hacerla de forma escalonada, es decir, cada vez que tenemos un caso de gran o bueno, un caso que sea, si cada vez vamos, que tengamos un caso de estos, vamos a salir a pedirle a la población ayuda, colaboración, ¿cierto? Como sucedió en España, o entonces que multiplique ese esfuerzo cada vez que vuelva a suceder, a repetirse ese caso, entonces que pues simplemente se vuelve algo inoperante y realmente como muy costoso. Entonces es mejor a través no de una fuerza policial o de que una entidad judicial obtener estas muestras, sino simplemente como un procedimiento común en la población, ¿cierto? Cuando, por ejemplo, van a la consulta médica a obtener una muestra y mandarla a los diferentes laboratorios y ahí sí ir creando las bases de datos. Pues esa es la opinión de él, ¿no? No
question. Bueno, mi todo muy interesante, ya satisfecho por así. Dos preguntas prácticas. Pues la primera es en lo que nos contó la historia de su caso, que fue más de 10 años después. Se y estaban las evidencias guardadas en Europa o en Inglaterra. En particular tenía un límite de tiempo que la ley permita guardar esas muestras y después se desechen o algo.
Okay.
Y si pasa, bueno, es como anexo a esa pregunta, y si pasa ese tiempo y es necesario reabrir un caso, ¿qué se hace? Okay. Esa es una
pregunta. Well, just going to the case that the first case that where the samples were kept for almost 14 years, right? He is asking me if under the British law there is a limit time that you should keep those samples, or they are kept for until the case is dead or the people is dead, or for how long those samples are kept. There is any legislation about it.
The answer to your question is it actually depends from force to force. Some of them destroy samples after 7 years, but really you shouldn't ever destroy them. The issue is where do you store them and how do you store them? So it actually, but the problem is that it depends. There isn't statutory legislation that says you cannot destroy samples from particular cases. And it has happened, especially if you have a conviction. Where things could have gone horribly wrong in this particular case is if the police had decided that this case has been properly solved and that they have no reason to keep these samples any longer. Now, some forces have routine policy to destroy, for example, after 7 years. In this case, because they didn't lose an appeal, it had got to the point where it would have been considered outrageous if the samples had been destroyed before a first appeal. What is interesting about it is that they didn't destroy it afterwards, and that's good. But it needs to have legislative force, in my opinion, to say you cannot destroy samples at all, and you must actually find a way of preserving them until a case can be solved. Because, you know, for the very reasons you mentioned, if these particular samples had been destroyed in, say, 1993, for example, they never would have solved this case. They wouldn't have had the resources. The investigation that followed, under the pressure that was brought to bear to get them to investigate, wouldn't have happened because they would have been able to say, well, we can't test this, we can't use these new samples. And this is the key point. You can have cases which look as though you can't ever solve them. But that is essentially saying forensic science is never going to catch up. Well, we know it does. Some of the things that we are now able to do, for example, if we'd been having this debate 10, 20 years ago, it would have been deemed a science fiction debate because nobody would have thought you could do all of these things. But you can. And in the future, you'll be able to do even more. To give an example, I don't know how many of you are aware of a new DNA testing system that is going to be used routinely in forensic casework in the United Kingdom shortly. It's called 15 loci multiplex. What happens with this particular system is they have developed a system that is so sensitive that it eliminates a lot of the problems that have been found with low template DNA. In particular, a system called low copy number had a problem of creating artifacts, and this unfortunately allowed some people to claim that an artifact was actually a proper band in the DNA profile that meant a person should be eliminated, when in actual fact it was an artifact, and probably fairly obvious that it was an artifact. And this is part of the problem. If you don't actually know where to look for artifacts and what you to expect with them, you can actually go down the wrong path. And it happened in the UK in a particular case of the Omar bombing, that they attacked low copy number to such an extent that they managed to secure an acquittal, which possibly they should not have achieved. The end result was that we have an institution called the Forensic Science Regulator, and his job is to investigate the use of forensic sciences and advise about how to use them. That's where I found out about 15 loci multiplex from. They passed 15 loci. They passed low copy number as fit for purpose. A full review of it by another authority also passed it fit for purpose. But now, with 15 loci multiplex, it gets rid of the problem of artifacts, and it also is because of the use of the number of loci on this. The random match statistic from 15 loci multiplex is actually going to be greater than the population of the world. And that is going to give a degree of certainty that has never been seen before. It is also going to mean that, to return to Rocio's question about cost, the cost is actually going to come down for DNA testing. The use of robots, which I'm not sure if you're aware of, but a lot of the laboratories, at least in the UK, use robots for some of the testing, the parts of the testing process, which reduces the cost. And also, so does competition, because you have a number of different providers of services who are going to be competing against each other. For example, if you have one lab that says, I can do this test and is validated to do this test, and they're charging, say, £1,000 per test, and you have another lab which is also properly accredited, and they say, we can do this for £500, which are you going to choose? It's fairly obvious you're going to go with the, as long as the quality is guaranteed, you're going to choose the cheaper option. And that in turn is going to drive down the price of the more expensive option. So in the end, costs are going to come down considerably. It will be expensive to start with, but give it a year or two and it won't be. Does that answer your question, Rodolfo?
Bueno, esto depende de la autoridad que tenga el caso. Existen diferentes criterios para mantener la muestra por un determinado tiempo, dependiendo del contexto del caso y si el caso todavía tiene cosas pendientes como apelaciones y todo esto. Hay unas jurisdicciones que las mantienen por 7 años y después de eso las destruyen. Pero generalmente hasta que el caso no se considere completamente cerrado, las muestras son conservadas. Pues también algo que le adicionó a la pregunta es que pues también todo depende de la tecnología que se tenga y de los pros y los contras. Menciona que va a haber una nueva tecnología que va a salir más o menos en 6 meses en el Reino Unido que se llama Low Copy Number, no sé qué significa eso, que simplemente al inicio puede ser un poquito costosa, pero que con el tiempo y la masificación va a ser más productiva y más rentable o pues más económicamente más manejable, porque va a haber mucha competencia de empresas que van a ofrecer este servicio.
Para incluirlos en bases de datos.
Para analizar ADN
en minúsculas cantidades.
Eso no se aplica para todos, para las que tienen
muy poca cantidad.
Tienen muchos artefactos y hay que saber
cómo. Sí, él dice que de hecho, si la técnica que se utiliza ahora, que es la. La que va a salir, pero se llama Low Size Multiplex. Es la nueva técnica que va a salir en más o menos 6 meses. Multiplicación de baja lado, yo creo que será eso. Creo que utilizan menos recuentos para amplificar. Entonces, ¿qué sucede? Que los artefactos no se van a presentar con tanta frecuencia como se presentan con el Low Template, Low Copy Number. Porque ya muchos abogados en el Reino Unido están argumentando que si algunos de los artefactos o si el pico que ayudó a decidir que eso era un match, realmente era un artefacto. Entonces que eso es la dualidad y que esta nueva técnica del 15 Low Side Multiplex va a eliminar. Okay, we're moving to the next
topic. If somebody has a question, let them ask it, but I'd like to move on after that, if that's okay.
Okay, it's up to you. Okay. Well, la última pregunta para que él siga, por favor.
No, pues pregunta.
¿Usted todo el tiempo?
¿Tres últimas preguntas?
Sí.
Three more.
Sorry, could I? There are other issues that I would like to deal with. So can we sort of, we can have the three questions, but there will be more questions following from, I would think, following from the other stuff.
Okay.
Do you want to explain?
No pude desayunar.
Y ahora estoy terminando.
Perdón.
Era
cierre. Keywords for the.
La laboratorio genética
con
la
genética que lab here.
Mi pregunta respecto a la permanencia de los perfiles genéticos en la base de datos, pero entiendo que tienen tres diferentes categorías, uno los condenados, otro los arrestados por cualquier tipo de lesión, de crimen, de delito, y otras personas que voluntariamente están donando su muestra. ¿Esos perfiles permanecen en la base de datos todos el mismo tiempo, alguna vez son retirados de la base de datos o siempre permanecen en la base de datos?
she understands that there are three sources how you feed the databases. One from the convicted people, another from people who has just been arrested, and people who have given the voluntarily. For how long this data remains in the databases? So what are the criteria to keep this data in the databases? They are forever, regardless of the sources?
It depends slightly, but the law allows the retention of the DNA forever, but you can challenge this, and some people have. For example, there was a case of a man named Martha, and a person referred to as S because he was a child. And this challenged the right of the National DNA Database to retain DNA forever for a person who hadn't given it voluntarily but had been compelled under the law of arrest, but not actually been proceeded with and not actually convicted. They took this case to the European Court of Human Rights, and they won. But the British government changed the law slightly and essentially just kept the old system, and they got away with it. As the European Court later effectively overturned its own decision and allowed them to do it. So at the moment, the situation is slightly complicated, but they can still retain or have it been able to retain DNA even if you haven't given it voluntarily for life. But this is one of the problems with it. The perception is that the database is not independent. In actual fact, it is. And it is actually very, very difficult. For example, people seem to think still the National DNA Database is controlled by the police. In actual fact, it never has been. It was all they were able to do was interrogate it in terms of asking whether there was any matches, and the database would do routine searches and turn up various people. And this is something that I'm going to come back to in the next sort of stage, because it is precisely this that managed to resolve two cases which were outrageous miscarriages of justice. If you had a system where you had to have only voluntary sort of people on the database, then the people who have most to lose from or most to gain from a system that only allows voluntary databasing is people who are actually committing crimes, because they're just not going to volunteer. And the thing about this is everybody was innocent once. Even Pedro Lopez was innocent once before he committed his first crime. And at that point, if you couldn't, and this is one of the key points in terms of Colombia and other countries, in that if you actually had the DNA of Pedro Lopez, I mean, I understand you wouldn't have because this was earlier, but take for example Garavito. If you had his DNA on a database from the very start, the first murder he committed, then you know it's him. You start investigating. That prevents all the others. And that's a key point with it. Garavito is never going to give his DNA voluntarily. You have to compel it. And that is the sort of point. If you were able or had suspected him, or he had been convicted or suspected of another offence, you would have been able to take his DNA. If you had taken his DNA and you had that on a Colombian database, an Ecuadorian database, and a Peruvian database, you would know what had been happening very, very quickly. The first crime he commits, you know that you've got to start investigating him, and that stops the rest. And this is the sort of point with it. If you have only you need to have a degree of consent to this, but you can get that consent early in the process. If you try and compel, you're going to run into problems.
Bueno, inicialmente él dice que la ley inglesa permite mantener esos datos por siempre, sí. pero sin embargo que esto ha sido controvertido varias veces por personas que han estado o que tienen están en la base de datos, personas especialmente que han sido arrestadas pero nunca condenadas. Relata el caso de una persona que controvertió, perdió ante las cortes inglesas, pero llevó su caso a la corte de la Unión Europea y ganó. Entonces, debido a esto, la ley cambió un poco, pero no como debe haber cambiado, y finalmente se hizo como una especie de lobby en la corte europea, y la corte europea revertió la decisión que había tomado. Por lo tanto, en este momento se permite que bases de datos estén por siempre, que las personas permanezcan en estas bases de datos. Él dice que la ventaja de tener un sistema donde las personas dan sus muestras voluntarias es que todos somos inocentes en algún momento de nuestra vida, y que pues nunca se sabe cuándo es que vamos a estar involucrados en algún evento. Entonces, que pues es el uso, y pero que la voluntad de la gente, o mejor, la gente se ve más reticente a colaborar si piensan que estos sistemas están administrados por la policía, ¿sí? Si es un sistema totalmente independiente, esto crea más seguridad, confidencialidad en el público, y pues van a dar sus muestras más, porque no están asociando dar la muestra inmediatamente con que se les va a asociar a una investigación criminal.
¿Él habló algo de Garavito?
Ah, bueno, él mencionaba precisamente eso, ¿no? Que Garavito pues fue inocente en alguna ocasión, y pues que si hubiese existido una base de datos voluntaria o eso, desde un principio hubiese sido posible encontrarlo, y que cometió crímenes en Perú y en el Ecuador, pues si hubiesen habido bases de datos en también países, pues lo mismo pues algo se hubiese podido hacer, ¿verdad?
Vamos entonces a continuar.
Yes.
Y las otras dos
muy
preguntas.
Muy bien. No, more question.
Okay.
Lo vas a dejar después.
Bueno.